Hello and welcome to another edition of Living with Dying, the podcast where we talk about all kinds of aspects around death. And today I'm very pleased to be joined by Peter Cooper, who's the son of Hazel Cooper, who I interviewed some time ago about the loss of her husband. And she gave a very moving interview, which I think inspired Peter to get in touch with me. And Peter, you said at the time that you had had a good amount of grief in your life and a kind of learning curve of grief. Would you like to tell me how that all began?
I grew up very much in the shadow, I was going to say, of my grandfather, but he never had the chance of my grandfather, my mum's dad, who was killed in 1943 in the invasion of Italy. He was on it was called a landing craft flak boat, Royal Marine, close support, and was injured in the head and died a few days later in Malta. And that was central to my experience of growing up with Mum, really. It was there in my childhood all the way through. And I was kind of conscious of that grandfather-shaped hole in our experience. And we had three grandparents rather than four. And my grandmother, my mum's mum, her attitude was to buy us lots of guns so that we'd get out of our system early, and my mum's was to not buy us any at all. So in between the two, it became the issue, and every time there was a war film on, if my grandma was here, we'd turn it off. So it was very current all the way through growing up, really. I remember hearing Mum crying on Remembrance Day. So it was normal, as far as we were concerned, because what you grew up with is normal, isn't it? And I didn't really realise how much it informed me, shaped me, moulded me, until I was quite a lot older, I think. And I think that's that, and my mum's response to her own experience drew me in towards being interested in CND in the 70s, when I was becoming a teenager and an adult. And a lifelong interest in peace. One of my biggest regrets is when we were looking at universities, there was a course in peace studies that just started at Bradford, and it was kind of ridiculed by the careers teacher as a kind of thing. And I really wish I'd looked into it more, because I think I'd have liked to do that. And just that one experience, really, one family, one child, 7 years old she was when he was killed. Unable, because everyone around her at the time was experiencing similar bereavements, knowledge of violent death all around, unable really to process it in the way that nowadays children would be encouraged to have counselling, speak about it, all the best, but she just got on with her life. And still now, it was the 70th anniversary 2 years ago of his being killed. She still feels guilty. She still apologises to us for grieving for her dad.
Oh.
Which I think is incredibly sad. And I think she mentioned him once when she spoke with you, very much kind of in passing. And I think that's where she's learned to, or felt she's had to keep it, is just as a footnote to her life. Whereas I mean, imagine if I'd lost a parent at 7 years old, how devastating that would have been.
So what exactly was she apologising to you for, the fact that she knew it had coloured your childhood?
As a family, we apologise all the time. It's a bit of a family trait. So I think, yes, that it had coloured and affected our childhood. And for me, it's kind of it's my heritage. I really value it. I kind of grew up knowing that death was there as a possibility, you know, which in our culture is very much hidden from us, I think. And I grew up with that kind of unacknowledged grief, kind of central to my experience. As I think of it now, I'm not ever quite sure if I'm doing grief properly. So I've had a few bereavements in my own life. I always feel like apologetic for some really undiscernible reason. Undiscernible? Indiscernible. That, yeah, I'm not doing grief properly.
What would be properly?
Who knows? I suppose the attitude I grew up with was that, you know, strong men don't cry. I learned not to cry as a boy. I was physically bullied quite a lot, and everyone told me, don't cry, that's what they want, so I didn't cry. And of course, I then became the boy who doesn't cry, and so even more of a target. So yeah, I had to learn to cry again in my 20s. That's quite liberating. I actually really enjoy crying now. I find it really liberating. So possibly there's a feeling still around that, you know, do men cry? And if men cry, how do they cry? How else? How do you do grief properly? I don't know, actually.
It's interesting that you judge yourself not doing it properly, but you haven't got an example in mind of what would be proper. Mm.
Yeah, that's interesting. It is interesting. I remember Grayson Perry did a really interesting series of programs on ritual around life events, and one of them was on death, and he looked at various different examples from around the world. The one I remember was it was an island that actually very soon after was destroyed by a hurricane, or massively impacted by a hurricane. But they had a tradition of keeping their deceased relative for as long as it took people to want to celebrate their life. So they would keep them in storage. I don't know how they managed to do it without decaying. And then about a year after they died, everyone would come together and have a really a big ritual about them. And that really interested me, the idea that you separate the period after death where you have that sense of loss to the ritual of actually finally being able to say goodbye to them.
Interesting that they take a year, isn't it? Because here you get the impression we're all supposed to get over it quite quickly. After the funeral, you're supposed to be on the way to returning to normal life.
Mm.
But it doesn't, it's not, that's not how it works.
Not in my experience. It was Patti Smith talking about her husband who died. I heard on Women's Hour a few years ago. And she said, I'm paraphrasing, but she said, people say time heals. And in my experience, it doesn't. It just lengthens the space between the wounds opening again, which was a really interesting way of putting it.
Mm.
I think that has been my more recent experience. There will be experiences of grief I have that hit me quite hard. My best friend of nearly 30 years and my performing partner died very suddenly in 2015. And it's weird, sometimes I wake up having dreamt of him, feeling incredibly sad still. My dad, as you know, died 2 years ago. It's taking a long time to process that one. as I'm sure it does for most people, actually. That's something that most of us will experience. And yet it's, as you say, it's something we're expected just to recover from quickly and get on. As I say, Mum still lives with it now. Still feels like she's holding on in some ways, to the experience. Maybe he wasn't able to fully explore.
So, having that as your background when you grew up, are you saying that that influenced how you dealt with every other death you came across?
I can't enunciate how and why again. But yeah, I've experienced in my adult life quite a few close people who've who've died. I've not really known how to do it. So I had a flatmate in the 90s who died of AIDS. Just actually 6 months after my daughter was born. So there was new life and there was death in the same year. And he took, between first developing AIDS and dying, took him about a year of being in and out of hospital. And it was before the antiretrovirals came out, so as soon as he experienced it, we all knew that, bar the very, very fortunate few, it was a death sentence. And there was quite a lot of guilt around that because we had all been sharing a house, and we would, when my partner at that time was pregnant, we were all going to move in together and share another house. And there was a meeting where we all sat around after he'd come out of hospital the first time, and from starting off planning how and when we were all going to move, it became apparent that he wasn't going to move with us. And that wasn't his decision, and it wasn't my decision. It kind of just evolved around us. There's a lot of guilt involved with that. And it was 1992, so at that time there was a lot of fear around it, a lot of, still not a lot of knowledge about how people pass on the infection, and the idea of giving birth in a family where someone had AIDS was just, it wasn't really tenable, and I can understand it, and he understood it, but it was, yeah, it was a very, yeah, I had a lot of guilt around it, still do actually.
And that was a loss, the loss that you weren't going to move in together.
Yeah, absolutely.
So would you say that was when your grief kind of began for him?
Yeah, actually. So then, yeah, it was a difficult time. Difficult time to experience grief, actually. I was 29 and it was quite early.
So that was a big loss for you, but you had others since, haven't you?
So Wayne, he was my, I met him in 1988 in a improvisation class. We became best friends and we ended up performing together at a double act. I used to earn my living as a medieval jester, actually, mainly, but I trained as a clown. And we had a show that never became a huge part of what I did because he was a bit of a polymath. He enjoyed doing lots of different things and never committed to one particular course in his life. He died suddenly of a heart attack, 2015, age 57. That was sudden and that was difficult. I still had him in my life as that kind of solid, dependable best friend, you know.
These are all significant losses, aren't they?
Hmm.
People who are important to you.
Yeah.
Do you reckon you did grieve properly for him?
I don't know. I cried, and there was he had a very compartmentalised life. Yeah, I was probably his longest living close friend. But there were other people who also considered him to be their best friend. And at his funeral, I was asked to speak by his sister and his partner. I remember one person especially was really upset because he felt that he earned the title best friend. And I said, I don't know. I had that insecurity around it, you know. Was I? Were we still? I needed a lot of reassurance at that point. His partner and his sister both kind of tried to provide that. He had quite a talent for being best friend with whoever he was with. Really a very good listener and very, you know, helpful energy to be around. Lovely man. And very funny. Very, very dry. Witty sense of humour. See, I've got tears in my eyes speaking about him.
Mm. Is that a gradual letting go of him then, perhaps?
Yeah, a letting go and a holding on, I think.
Is that what you have difficulty with, letting go?
I don't know. I will, by default, think I've not behaved well or done something not properly or not well or wrong.
So that's the basis on which you question whether you do grief properly or not. It's this feeling of never getting it right, isn't
it? Yeah, I think so. And that's been part of the grieving process after Dad died. Or actually, before he died, and we sat, my elder brother and I sat with him for the last week of his life after he was put on palliative care. And there was, I still can't understand why we didn't figure it. Well, there was that phone call you get, which is, you better come now because we've got a meeting with the palliative care consultant and we're going to discuss what happens next. And we met with the consultant and the palliative care nurses, my mum, both my brothers. And the only person who wasn't part of that conversation was Dad. And he had capacity. He possibly had some degree of dementia, but he hadn't enacted his power of attorney, and we had it in a different room, and no one told him till somewhere near the middle of that next week that he was dying.
There's a tendency, isn't there, to think the patient is kind of beyond it, whereas the patient is the most important person.
Mm. Yeah, and he was in and out of consciousness or sleep or whatever it was, and he had to have an obturator in his mouth because he'd had jaw cancer and it didn't fit by then, so he found speech really difficult. He'd also had lock jaw since he'd had the operation, so speech had been difficult for years, but he had capacity and he could have made himself he did make himself understood through that week. He asked me, am I dying, at one point, sitting with him.
What did you say?
Yes, Dad, I'm afraid you are. And I asked him, did he want me to sit with him? Or would he rather be on his own? And he said he wanted to be on his own for a bit. Didn't have the kind of relationship that some people develop where they can talk about all the difficult times. It was, our adult relationship was very polite.
So that meant you were not only losing him, you were losing the chance to resolve it.
Mm.
The chance to talk about it.
Yeah. It would have felt unbelievably cruel to raise it at that point. And when would have been the opportunity? Because it was one of those cliches you see it all the time, reenacted on television or in radio plays. You know, adult child rings home and father says, I'll get your mother. And that's exactly how it was, you know. And he'd stand awkwardly at the door as we left, and would we hug, would we kiss, or would we shake hands, you know. That generation of men found it. I'm projecting, but I didn't experience him as having an easy relationship with his own emotions. And his anger was, and frustration and depression were his central experience, I think.
But I can see it's left you with a hell of a lot of sadness and sorrow and tears and feeling of losses, hasn't it?
Mm. He'd written his own funeral. He'd left it all planned out with an order of service already prepared, and each hymn was introduced with a memory as to why it was there and what memories it brought up and all the rest of it. And it was all about love. And Mum said at some point a few months later, never talked about that when he was alive. It was obviously really important to him. If only in that's how you wanted to be remembered, you know. I don't think, I think you don't write that kind of thing if you don't have some kind of personal experience of it. I remember telling him, it was during the pandemic. I live in Devon, and my stepson has very complex needs and an immunodeficiency, which meant that we basically locked down for 2.5-3 years, didn't see anyone, didn't go out. Everything was over the phone. I remember speaking to Dad at some point in the 2.5-3 years, and he had difficulty speaking, as I say, and we had one of those awkward conversations, and he was getting irritated that I couldn't understand what he was saying on the phone. It irritated him a lot, and he was going quite deaf as well, so he couldn't hear very well. And I said, none of this matters, Dad. Just know that I love you. And there was quite a long silence. I could feel dead at home. And it was, you know, for all our difficulties, it was completely true. I was really proud of him, because he had a very difficult emotional life, and what he managed to achieve in terms of receiving what was thrown at him and changing. So his background, the 60s didn't do very well for him, because he started the 60s being told that if he just worked hard, he would reap the benefits by the time he got to middle age and would be, you know, part of the management team. And of course, by the end of that decade, youth was the in thing, so he was then too old. So he never progressed to where he was promised when he first started. And then his first grandchild was born when Andy, my brother, was only 21, 22. That was a huge, huge shock to them both. And they changed through that, and then Brian came out a few years later, and they changed through that, and they kind of just accepted everything that was thrown at them, and made the changes that they needed to make to embrace and accept and it was a life to be proud of in that respect.
So that kind of brings us up to date then, talking about the loss of your father. But are you still worrying that you didn't grieve for him in the way that you think you ought to be grieving?
It's really complex. I don't know whether I grieved for him, whether I did right by him as he was dying. I sometimes question whether I really know what love is. I clearly do. And yet, yeah, there's that kind of feeling that I don't do it properly. Didn't do it properly.
Thank you very much for sharing all that with us, Peter. It's been fascinating listening to you.
Well, thank you. I've kind of used it as a therapy session, I guess.
Well, it's been lovely to meet you. Thank you ever so much again.
Not at all.
Death is never easy, but there are ways we can help each other through it. And if you've found any of these episodes helpful, please think about liking and sharing. And if you can help spread the word by telling just one other person, thank you. And a huge thanks to Joe Barrett, without whom these podcasts would simply not be possible. You can contact us on hello@livingwithdying.co.uk.